Hello and welcome in.
First Science.
Because he shows them the magic and mystery of science in everyday living.
On Science Mixtape on Soho Radio.
Welcome! It is the bank holiday weekend here in London, and the most anticipated event of the summer is around. No, I'm not talking about Carnival. I'm talking about the annual International Conference of Brain Informatics and Health. Yep, that's happening this weekend. I know you've all had it in your diaries for months, so don't lie. So joining us today in a celebration of that is Yasmin Galbraith, a former biomedical Hello. Scientist and now comms officer at the medical charity Ataxia UK.
Yes, that's where I am.
Yeah. Now, I didn't actually know what Ataxia was until very, very recently.
Yeah, well, that's quite common. It's not very, well, it's quite a rare condition and it's not very well known. It's not well publicised, but basically what it is, well, from ataxia from the Greek, it literally means lack of order. So it's a neurological condition that affects movement and balance and speech. And it can be in varying degrees of severity. It can be inherited. It can be assigned from other conditions. There's thousands of different types, but it's not so well known.
Yeah, fascinating. Well, we're going to be hearing more about that later in the show, along with Yasmin's personal experiences of a very scary sounding exploding head syndrome.
True story.
A true thing. So stay tuned for that. And of course, for our weekly experiment this week, you only need two rulers, like the long ones, not 15 centimetre ones. If you can get a metre ruler, even better. But yeah, all you need is two rulers. So there we go. And finally, get us really started is our weekly brain teaser. Now, this one claims that it's a puzzle for your whole brain. And apparently it touches on analytical functions like abstract reasoning, hypothesis testing, and implicit assumptions residing in your frontal lobes. So I thought it would be appropriate. Here goes. A blind beggar had a brother who died. What relation was the blind beggar to the brother who died? I'm going to give you a clue already, and brother is not the answer. So get your head around that one. And if you think you know the answer, you can tweet us at Soho Radio. I'm going to leave Yaz pondering that for a bit.
Yeah, I'm going to be thinking about that one.
And we'll come to that at the end of the show. Now, you've chosen all the music today.
I have.
And what are we going to kick off with?
Well, we're going to kick off with something really close to my heart in general. And anyone who's ever met me probably knows this. I love Sean Paul. I think my gravestone will read, Here Lies Yasmin, Sean Paul was underrated. this is like my favourite song in the whole world ever. It's not just Sean Paul. Sean Paul's at his best when he's collaborating, of course. So this is Sean Paul and Blue Cantrell. Breathe. All we do is make up, then break up. Why don't we wake up and see when love hurts, it won't work. Maybe we need some time alone. We need to let it breathe.
So what's not supposed to be about daily? Get free of the vibe and stop acting crazy. Reminisce on all the good times.
Yes, 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 it is science news and this big story of the week, which you've chosen to kick off with, Yasmin.
Okay, me first.
Yeah.
Well, yes, this is something that's been going around for the past few days. It's a sort of an article, a study about science, so how science works sort of thing. And it's reporting on how a study sort of given a pretty bleak outlook on the state of the psychology research, and a major study just found that only 36% of the original findings in all of the studies that they chose could actually be reproduced. So that doesn't look great on paper.
So this is like, they're calling it the reproducibility project, aren't they? And they tested like 100 different studies
that
were published in major journals.
Yeah, they weren't small studies. Yeah.
And to see if they could replicate the results. And literally, it's like, so some of them were social psychology and
some of them were cognitive. Yeah. And 75% of the social psychology experiments, couldn't be replicated. And half of the cognitive couldn't be replicated.
Do you think that's surprising?
I don't know. It's sort of, there's so many reasons why a study couldn't be replicated. It could just be a chance the second time around, or it doesn't necessarily mean that the findings were completely wrong and you have to throw them out. But yeah, it is important to test reproducibility, because if you only get the results once, it's pretty meaningless.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you can't just think that one study is the answer to everything.
Yes. Like, and when they're making quite sweeping things as well, you can easily do in like cognitive and social psychology, sort of make assumptions about behavior which are very far reaching. And if it's just one study one time said it, and then it sort of falls into the scientific landscape.
Literature. Yeah. I think there was a hilarious quote that I really enjoyed from the one from Alan Crowd. He said, "The only findings that will replicate 100% of the time are likely to be trite, boring and already known, such as dead people can't talk to read."
Yeah, well, it's true. He's got a point. But the study also, they do give, explanations for other reasons or why, rather than everything being wrong, rather than that, why they might not be able to reproduce them. It could be like a number of different factors, but when the reproducibility is that low, then you've really got to sort of question maybe the method or even what your start point is.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think it's actually a really important story, because people have been sort of claiming in headlines, they're like, oh, science is broken, but I think it's actually really important to sort of show that science is actually quite an uncertain process.
Yes.
And this is exactly how science works. Like, you do an experiment and you see if it's correct, but you've got to do it again and again and again, and there'll be factors that you haven't thought of the first time that will only come to light after a while. I think in a way it's really good that this uncertainty is broadcast a bit more.
Oh yes, definitely, because there's sort of the assumption that, oh no, we got the results, that's 100% right, and we can't question it again. And yeah, you should be bringing things back and re-examining them and re-evaluating them in later years, and maybe you won't find the same thing, and maybe it'll be totally different.
Yeah. And like, funding wise what it takes to be like a successful academic is to publish loads of papers.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. And they said, yeah, successful academic doesn't equal successful scientist.
Yeah, because there's not really funding for reproducibility, so that's another reason why this is such an important project. One of my favourite stories this week, which is also neuroscience and brain related, was all about a really new technique in brain surgery. So there was a student on Imperial who had a brain tumour that they wanted to remove. And this it kind of went all round, because they had to get him to sing during his surgery.
Oh, that's quite common. They used to get people to like play the guitar if they can do that.
Yeah.
And so you can check, you can check if you miss a bit.
If you're going to like remove some of their vital functions.
Yeah.
But yeah, basically when you're removing a tumour, you want to try and make sure you've got all of it, because even just one remaining cell could regrow the whole tumour. And in the past, they've had to use like quite slow methods. Like, if they're not sure about a particular bit of tissue, they might take a biopsy, have it examined. It takes like 45 minutes before they're like, yeah, cut or don't cut. Mm-hmm. And this new laser technique, literally, you shine a light, the laser probe, onto the tissue, and it causes the cells to vibrate. And then they reflect the light with different frequencies. And these get analysed, and healthy tissue versus like abnormal cancerous tissue will have slightly different like signature frequencies. And so you can tell within literally like a few seconds whether you want to cut out that bit of tissue or not. And it's completely non-invasive. So it's just amazing. Like absolutely fascinating. It's going to sort of revolutionise, I think, brain surgery.
Yeah.
Amna, what was your top story of the week?
It's quite exciting. This is kind of the first research that's found a smart drug to be safe.
I've been reading a lot about this.
So there's this drug, and it's meant for narcolepsy. It's modafinil, and it's, you know, it's used for different types of sleep disorders. But it's an over-the-counter drug. You can order it online. And what researchers have realised that there's this whole underground use for it, where students are using it to, you know, do better in their exams or finish their coursework.
Yeah, it's like rife in America, isn't it?
It's really, really popular, but no one told me about it when I was a student. But they actually looked at all of the data that's ever existed on this. So it was a meta-analysis, and then they found that it does actually work. It does help, you know, cognitive functions. They think that it might help increase blood flow, but they're not too sure. But it does make you more awake, and it helps with your memory a little bit as well. And then they found that there were actually no like terrible side effects in the short term. This is only, I think, doing it for a few days or months. It's not a very long-term study. But they're saying maybe we need to look into the ethics of this, because if it is safe and loads of students are doing it, is it fair?
But was the study sort of for like using it daily, or using it sort of as a like a hit, so you can stay awake to study,
it was more of a hit, definitely. Oh, okay. So just people doing it just before that exam, or trying to do that last paper,
the last page of that
dissertation or something. And it just works for them. So
I actually went, at uni there was a really interesting talk on this sort of thing. So firstly, like, it is really good that they are finally testing it, what the effects in healthy people, because if it is being used, then we want to know if there are going to be side effects. But she was also saying, yes, if it's safe, and like you said, the ethics of it. A lot of, they did a questionnaire where they asked a lot of people, you know, would you ever give performance enhancing drugs to your kids?
Yeah.
And most people in the questionnaire said no. I mean, a developing brain, we don't know what's going on. Like, you definitely wouldn't want to be giving it to your kids. But in the same survey, so the same respondents, it said, you know, if your 1 4-year-old was in a class where everyone else had given their kids performance enhancing drugs, would you give it to yours? And a lot of them said yes.
Yeah.
So even though they're there and they're like, oh,
people are strange.
Yeah, but like, it's bad to give it to a kid. Then they're like, but I don't want my kid to be disadvantaged.
But people, I guess, without using a specific drug, people definitely, some parents get quite into, you know, the right diet, the right amount of exercise, the right amount of sleep, like really curating the ideal environment for their kids to grow up and be a genius. And I guess it's the stigma of it being a little pill that you take rather than, you know, eating lots of spinach.
Yeah, I suppose so, actually. I guess it's just,
like, if you asked a parent, would you adjust your child's diet? I think you'd find it was, everyone would say yes, but you're still putting things into your body. I guess there's, with the drug, you just don't know if there's going to be side effects.
Whereas people have eaten spinach for years, no one's a bit safer.
Yeah. It's if the number one, the stigma, and if the trials all proved there was no, you know, no adverse effects that was noticeable, maybe people would be more on board. I don't know. But yeah, then there's an ethics with it. It's like doping in sports almost.
Yeah, I think it's such an interesting area, and I don't know what the correct answer is.
No, it's probably not one.
Could talk about it for days. Yeah. So a few quick more news headlines. A woman gave birth after she had a womb transplant from her mother.
I read about this.
Yeah, crazy. And Sierra Leone is now free from Ebola. That is the sound of the nurses celebrating as the final patient leaves the hospital.
Oh, yeah, I saw this video.
Yeah, absolutely fantastic. And on that note, I think we should have a little bit more music. So what are we going for next?
Play a bit of Stromae.
I love Stromae. Why have you chosen this one?
Because I lived in Brussels in Belgium for the last 2 years, and I just moved back to London, and he is Belgian and obviously very big there. And I kind of, yeah, I love him. He's great.
So this is Tula Mem. Tu diras au revoir à ta mère. Elle qui t'idéalise, tu ne vois même pas tout ce que tu perds. Avec une autre, ce serait pire. Quoi, toi aussi, tu veux finir maintenant? C'est le monde à l'envers. Moi, je le disais pour te faire réagir seulement. Toi, t'y pensais. Rendez-vous, rendez-vous, rendez-vous au prochain règlement. Rendez-vous, rendez-vous, rendez-vous sûrement au prochain rêve. Welcome back. At the start of the show, we gave you a brain teaser, which was, a blind beggar had a brother who died. What relation was the blind beggar to the brother who died? And our clue was that brother is not the answer. And this is testing your assumptions and cognitive reasoning. So tweet us in at Soho Radio if you think you know the answer. We're going to be coming back to that one at the end of the show. But now it is time for our experiment of the week.
Yes.
And in keeping with the kind of neuroscience theme, I thought it'd be good to do a reaction time experiment. So literally all you need for this is two rulers. There you go, can you hear them there? Me and Yaz are going to have a little competition.
We are.
To see who has the quicker reaction time.
Yeah, I'm really going to not put bets on myself. I'm really tired.
So if you're playing along at home, I should have said, like, you need another person with you in order to do this. You can't do this by yourself.
Yeah, it's like trying to tickle yourself. It's not going to happen.
Yeah, like, you know when you're going to drop the ruler. So the premise is, I'm going to hold two rulers, and Yas is going to have her hands just at the base of the ruler. And you want to have your fingers and thumb, like, maybe it's sort of 6 centimetres apart. So to make sure that it's fair and, you know, we're controlling our variables, I'm going to ask Yas to just get her fingers the width of a bottle.
done
on both hands.
Both hands.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, we're having a.
So that they are the same height, and then I'm going to hold the two rulers, so the base is there, and I'm not going to tell her which one I'm going to drop, and I'm just going to drop one of them, and she has got to notice and react
and catch it. It didn't go through okay. My hand.
So that was my fault. There was a slight wobble there. We're just going to have one more go.
We'll have one more quick go.
And the way this works is as you catch it, the position that you catch it on the ruler will determine how fast you caught it. So
yes.
Okay, we're ready to go again. Ooh.
Awful.
So Yaz caught that right at the top of the ruler.
Yeah, literally on the 28th centimetre.
28th centimetre. Now, I found a table online which converts...
Does it mean I'm dead?
It means that your reaction time was about 0.24 seconds.
I don't know if that's very good, is it?
I don't think it's that bad, because you've got to be... Your eyes have got to notice which ruler is falling.
Yes.
And then you've got to send the signal to your hand telling the correct one to
the
squeeze.
Right hand, yeah.
So now we're going to see what I get.
Okay.
Okay, so I'm setting my hands up with the bottle.
Yes. Okay, you ready?
Yeah. Ooh!
She did phenomenally better than me.
I caught it in about 10 centimetres, so that's a 0.14.
I think this just shows how like tiredness can affect the body.
Absolutely.
In so many ways. I'm assuming I'm more tired than you.
There are so many things that could affect reaction time.
Yes.
Also, like, when we put on our next song, we should probably do a bit of reproducibility ourselves.
I think that's quite important.
Yeah, yeah. At least three tests each.
Yeah. Real science.
Well, it says here the average time for humans for a visual stimulus is 0.25 seconds.
Yeah, so you were bang on average.
You are average.
Fantastic. That's literally the nicest thing anyone said to me all week.
If you try that at home, tweet us in and let us know your reaction times. Brilliant. So the next song, what are we going to be having?
Should we go for Pulp? I think we should continue like the...
Pulp, Common People.
Yeah.
Excellent. Now, just before I let that song play, we've got a new feature starting this week called 3 Minute Science, which is going to happen straight after the song. And this is Kyle, who was been on the show before and is studying a PhD at Imperial. He is interviewing people, or will be over the course of different programmes, to summarise their science in 3 minutes. So listen out for that at the end of the song. I said, pretend you got no money. And she just laughed and said, oh, you're so funny. I said, yeah. I can't see anyone else smiling. Are you sure? You wanna live like common people. You wanna see whatever common people see. Wanna sleep with common people. You wanna sleep with common people like me. But she didn't understand. And she just smiled and held my hand. 3 Minute Science.
3 Minute Science.
My name is Kyle Major, and I'm a researcher at Imperial College in quantum optics. Explain your research in 3 words. Light, molecules, quantum. Explain your research to a colleague. I do cavity quantum electrodynamics experiments with single dye molecules in optical fiber microcavities. Explain your research to a 4-year-old. I shine very bright light onto small bits of stuff and see how it behaves. Explain your research to a politician. I am trying to build a computer that works with light instead of electricity, that will be much faster than traditional computers and will solve problems that traditional computers can't even solve. What's the goal? Well, so the goal for my experiment is to use single dye molecules as a source to generate single particles of light, single photons. Why? Well, single photons are very useful because they behave in a quantum mechanical way, and they can behave in a way that's different and interesting, and it can be used as a resource to do other experiments and for things like quantum computing or quantum metrology, where you can measure things much, much better. Why do you do it? I do it because I'm an experimentalist and I like fiddling with stuff. So I really like, in the lab, taking things apart and putting them back together and putting new things together that no one else has ever put together before, so that's why I enjoy it. What did you do yesterday? Well, at the moment I am writing up my PhD, so I spent all day in front of a computer writing about what I've been doing for the last few years. Where will this research be in 5 years? I think that we are at a point now in trying to build a quantum computer that we're at in the 30s and 40s building normal computers. We know a bit of the in theory how to build them, and we've built some of the components, but we haven't really put the whole thing together yet. And putting the whole thing together will be the really interesting thing. But you won't see a quantum computer for the next 20 or 30 years.
3 minute science.
3 minute science.
And thank you to Kyle for that. Those of you may have spotted, this was his first one, so he's actually interviewing himself, which I thought was great.
It's quite sweet.
And I love the variation of explaining research to a four-year-old and
yeah.
explaining research to a politician. Like, it just really kind of, I thought, captured everything in a really good
way. Yeah, really good.
Great way. But moving on, as promised, we are going to be asking Yaz all about her exploding head syndrome.
Very accurate.
So, what is it?
Okay, well, that is actually the real name. It's not some, you know, antiquated term. That is still the real name. And it's a sleep disorder. And I don't think it's so common, but I think it's quite common for people to experience one of these things at some point in their life. And the exploding head part sort of comes from a combination of all these different components. So it's sleep paralysis with auditory hallucinations, and sort of the main symptoms of general sleep paralysis are you're aware of being awake, you can't move because you have, you know, your muscles become atonic when you start to fall asleep, you have no muscle tone, and people think that maybe this is because so you stop yourself from acting out your dreams.
Oh yeah, so you don't just like be a dog like chasing a rabbit.
Yeah, yeah. So lots of sleep disorders are based sort of around the REM sleep, the time of dreaming, or when you fall into a different wave of sleep, different stage. So it's sort of you're lying down, you can't asleep, but you're awake and you can't move at all, and you sort of feel a sort of quite commonly a rising sense of dread and fear, and people often report like seeing something coming across the room towards them, or like feeling a great weight on their chest and they can't breathe. So this is exactly what it feels like. So I'm lying down and I can't breathe and I can't move and I feel very afraid for no discernible reason. But the exploding head part comes in, where you end up getting sort of, it starts off as a sort of low ringing in your ears, but it's coming in from inside your own brain, and it just gets louder and louder and louder and louder until it's really just this huge crescendo that sounds like a gun going off in your ear, and then you sort of snap back and you're wide awake and you wake up with a gasp and a scream. Usually it must be quite terrifying for someone up to watch, and it's definitely scary to experience.
Oh my god,
the first couple of times I really thought that, oh, I'm dying, I'm having a stroke or something, this is terrifying. But then I was always fine, and then I didn't really do any googling about it, because I think that can end up down
you can just really scare
yeah
yourself.
The first thing would definitely be brain tumor or something like that, like it always is.
Yeah.
So a couple of weeks later, by pure coincidence, and I was at university in a neuroscience lecture, and we were having a lecture on sleep disorders, and the lecturer, she was talking about, you know, all different sorts of sleep disorders, and then she sort of tacked on the end a list of, you know, little unusual ones, and then she described the exploding head syndrome, and I just like shot my hand in there like that, I have that. for the first time I really was like, oh, it's a thing, I didn't imagine it. And it was just by pure coincidence, it was about a month later after the first time it happened. So I spoke to her about it, and she was like, oh, it's a bit unusual, there's nothing bad can happen, it's just
nothing to worry about. Yeah. Oh, that's so good to like be reassured.
Yeah, because sleep paralysis is quite common, quite commonly people will experience that maybe once in their life.
Do you find, so like, how often do you get it, and is there something that kind of triggers it?
Probably on average, since it started about 4 years ago, 3-4 years ago, I guess it probably only happened about 10 or 15 times. So a couple of times a year. And if I'm really, really, really tired, if I've not slept for 24 hours for whatever reason,
then, say deadline or something.
Yeah, something like that. And then I'll just try and go to bed, and then you know that complete overtiredness, that complete body exhaustion. I can sort of, you can feel it coming on almost, like the
prepare yourself, the dread starts.
That's the thing. That's common with all sorts of sleep paralysis. People report a feeling of rising dread and fear, or like something coming across them from the other side of the room, something sitting on their chest, like something trying to get them and kill them.
I guess, like, because so much of our body is geared up to perceive external stimuli.
Yes.
And then actually, if you've got something happening internally, like you're saying, this ringing is coming from in your head, it's not external, or something that's making your body feel dread, like you, it's taking these signals that have got internal causes and giving them external ideas. Like you said, like the feeling of something's hot on your chest. Because you were telling me as well, like, this used to be documented in folklore as like the original nightmare.
Well, actually, this is where the word nightmare comes from. The word nightmare was first used to describe sleep paralysis, and it's sort of fallen into a different usage in modern times. That's, so you hear these stories about, you know, like witches and hags and what's it, incubi, those things that will like come at night and like, you know, attack you and try and kill you and strangle you or come across the room towards you. And it really is just like something going, you know, a little bit haywire inside your brain when you're trying to fall asleep or have just fallen asleep, and you're perceiving it as an external threat. That's the only way sort of you can make sense of that, I think.
Yeah, and what else is crazy is that this is like being documented in folklore across loads of different cultures.
Yeah, every culture sort of got their own version of this sort of nighttime creature that comes and, you know, comes towards you and strangles you. But it's bizarre that it's so culturally folkloric and all of this all intertwined in stories and, you know, books, and then it's just this strange, like, you know, neurological quirk.
And I mean, sleep in itself is such a fascinating kind of neuroscience land that's still fairly undiscovered. Like, we still don't fully know why we need to sleep. We know there's a lot going on with kind of learning and memory. We know what happens if we don't sleep.
We die if we don't sleep, but
they've done studies on rats, and after like a couple of 2 weeks, I think, like, if you don't let the rat sleep, and they do this by the rats on like a little like block surrounded by water, and if it relaxes as it goes to sleep, it falls into the water, which wakes it up, it will die, which is quite extreme. Like, sleep is clearly a fundamental process and really important, and there's loads of new research as well linking kind of chronic sleep deprivation, people only sleeping, you know, 4 to 6 hours a night or having shift work, being associated with a lot of diseases later in life, like cardiovascular disease, diabetes, even some cancers, and it's fascinating, but we still just don't fully understand
it. And that's why sort of when you have like disorders, it sort of holds a mirror up to it as well, because then you can sort of see it from another angle rather than this.
When you see what's wrong, it gives you an idea of how it normally works.
I
think it's fascinating, and everyone sleeps, and you'd think like from an evolutionary point of view, like knocking yourself out for a third of your life, leaving yourself vulnerable to predators and things. Like, why was that advantageous?
That's the really weird thing, because sleep is so vital. We just don't know why we do it. And a really famous researcher, he said the only thing we know about sleep is that we sleep. Really,
I wonder if it's like, do more complex animals need more sleep? Because ants, this is so cool. Ants only sleep for 8 minutes twice a day.
Really?
Yeah, literally. That's all they need.
But cats sleep, they need 18 hours or something to function normally.
That blows my theory.
Well, you don't know.
General
cats
trend.
Could be operating on a higher plane that none of us are aware of.
Absolutely. Well, time for a little more music. What are we having next?
Sixpence None the Richer, Kiss Me.
Yeah, absolutely.
This is a wonderful song.
Kiss me out of the bearded barley nightly, beside the green, green grass. Swing, swing, swing the spinning step. You wear those shoes and I will wear that dress. Oh, kiss me.
Beautiful song for a Sunday morning. And it's the part of the show where we find out a little bit more about our guest. So, Yasmin, we said at the top of the show that you work for Ataxia UK.
Yes, a charity.
Yeah, you gave us a brief description of what Ataxia was.
Yes.
but I'm going to ask you to go into a little bit more detail.
Okay, well, like I said, there's lots of different types of ataxia, so you can't sort of round it all off with one sentence, really, but to describe sort of the symptoms that you, if you have ataxia or one of the many different forms of ataxia, like I said, you're going to have problems just sort of controlling voluntary movements, so problems with walking and speaking, just lots of involuntary movement. People with ataxia are often in wheelchairs or often require, you know, adaptations to their home to be able to, you know, live with the condition. And
is it something you're born with or something you develop?
It can be both, really. Well, there's genetic forms of ataxia, like Friedreich's ataxia is the most notable of these, and then you're born with that, and it's progressive and degenerative, or you can develop it. There's links between sort of gluten ataxia, and you can get it as a side of, as a symptom of MS, and it's lots of different. It's more like a neurological sign in some cases. When it's genetic, you have also like cerebellar ataxia, and when it's genetic, it's you're born with it, obviously, and then you can also develop it as a symptom of another neurological problem, so like a neurological sign of there being a problem with that area.
So in some ways it sounds a little bit similar to the symptoms someone might have after a stroke. Would you say like a stroke could give you ataxia, or is it not the same?
It's a little bit different after a stroke, maybe. I can see where you're coming from, but like, yeah, the speech is a little like slurred for some people.
I guess it's not the whole group of symptoms.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's the main difference. Well, and tell us more about what your charity does for ataxia.
Ataxia UK, it's, you know, dedicated charity for people with ataxia. So what I do for Ataxia UK is I work mainly with a magazine that we produce and doing other communications work too. And the magazine is for people with ataxia, their carers, people, anyone with a vested interest, researchers, we report on new research in the area. We've got some nice exciting new collaborations with Oxford University and Pfizer, and lots of good work that's happening at the moment, so it's nice to be able to report on that. But also we sort of have personal stories about people with ataxia, what they're doing, what they're achieving, and you know, people who are doing fundraising, things like that. So yeah, because we're a charity, fundraising is a big part of that, lots of events and people trying to get people to fundraise for us. And I should say, if anyone was interested in doing any fundraising or just learning a little bit more, just go to ataxia.org.uk, and we've got a really good and helpful website with a nice snazzy video, which I think is trying to, if you take a look at it, sort of supposed to sort of maybe create the discord of the, you know, body and mind sort of feeling that someone with ataxia might experience. It's a nice video.
I'm just playing a little bit of the audio from that now.
Yes, very atmospheric.
Yeah, this isn't just, you know, something going wrong with the radio. This is actually trying to represent the feeling of your mind and your body being disengaged from each other, which must be so terrible.
Yeah, it must be just, very hard to reconcile that within yourself, that, you don't have control over your own body.
Yeah.
Can you imagine?
And what do you find are like the challenges of communicating this to people? What do you find are the challenges of communicating this?
Well, like you said, you'd never heard of ataxia. I think the fact that it's quite uncommon, quite rare, and it's not really spoken about. Sometimes even people who have ataxia, they go to their doctor and they don't know what to recommend. They've not heard of it because there's so many different types.
So even doctors might not always.
Yeah, people in the medical communities, it's not something that you're aware of. And yeah, definitely people tell us, oh, you know, my doctor hadn't heard of it. Didn't know what to recommend because there's no cure. So it's, you have to sort of just manage it. And there's lots of different challenges to that. And I'm learning so much about what it must be like to live with that.
And how did you get involved in the first place? Like, obviously, well, you're really interested in neuroscience in general.
Yeah, yeah. Well, my first degree was in biomedical science. I did that here in London, and I sort of then chose not to pursue the traditional scientific career route. And then I ended up doing, after winding my way through some internships in Brussels, like I said, I ended up doing a master's in communications. So it was sort of my yeah, quite specific aim, I guess, niche aim to work in the healthcare charity sector in communications. So that's how I found myself here.
Amazing.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I find it really interesting. And it's sort of, yeah, a nice little world to exist in as well.
And especially with one that's actually so much that's still not known about it. That must be quite exciting.
Yeah. There's quite a lot of research being done, because there's not very much to go on, then any sort of small discovery can be really, really big.
Have you got any favourite stories from the ataxia community?
Lots of the stories are quite sad, so it's but it's always nice when I'm writing articles and someone's sending in me and my sister, we were both diagnosed with ataxia last year, and here's a picture of me doing a skydive for money, raising money for the charity.
That's great.
Yeah, it's quite, those are lovely things to hear about. Yeah,
really nice. We are almost coming up to the end of the show. So before we leave you all,
yes,
I'm going to have to announce the answer to the riddle.
Oh, good.
Do you think you know the answer, Yaz?
I've got absolutely no idea. To be honest, I've given it very little thought. So not the brother. So is it sort of, is he like a monk or something? And then his brother is...
So like I said, I mean, I'm going to hold my hands up and say I didn't get this either. Yeah. I didn't spend that long trying, but I was just like, how can he not be his brother? Like, I'm so confused.
And you sort of fixate on that rather than thinking about anything else.
We've both made a really interesting assumption. We've assumed that the blind beggar is a boy. That blind beggar is a girl. And so she is the sister of the dead brother. And I mean...
How strange.
Yeah, so this is a very reproducible social psychology experiment about assumptions. And I guess, like, the greater proportion of beggars that you see on the street are male. So that's maybe why we're making that assumption.
And I think also maybe just even the use of the word brother, like, just you associate, you know, brother,
masculine.
Yeah, they
all masculine. Start with Bs, yeah. Like BBB, blind beggar, brother. And you just kind of have...
Boy.
Yeah, boy. You're just not thinking about the gender. You've just, in your head, you're picturing...
Yes,
that beggar, and you just picture them as a man, and you don't question that assumption.
Yeah.
So that was our riddle for you this week.
If you got it.
Yeah. And what song do you want to end on?
I think I want to end on Macy Gray. I Try. This is just one of my favourite songs ever, and it just really reminds me of having really long car journeys with my mum as a kid, because she always had like 4 CDs, and this was one of them. I just love it, and. It's a great one. It's a Saturday morning. Why not?
Yeah, feel good one. So here we go. Macy Gray, I Try. Thank you all for listening, and we'll see you again next week. And thank you, Yaz, for joining us.